Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Tusco, and I'm a storyteller who makes history accessible because I believe it's a pathway to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, and being so much more deeply in touch with our own humanity. So this is a supplementary episode. This is a coffee chat that I had with Dan Kostelec. He's also known as Shakespeare Approves, your friendly neighborhood Shakespeare. And he dropped into the Tudor Learning Circle a couple of weeks ago and had a little chat with us. If you're not already a member of the Tudor Learning Circle, you should totally join. It's free. TudorLearningCircle.com. We have lots of great chats and discussions, a book club, all that kind of stuff. So TudorLearningCircle.com for that. And I also want to remind you that my kick-ass Tudor Women course is available on the Himalaya Learning app. So this is an app that's all just courses by people like Malcolm Gladwell and Seth Godin and all kinds of amazing people. And you know what? They chose me, little old me, to do a course for them on Tudor women. So you can listen to it on the Himalaya app. And so that's himalaya.com/kickass to find out more. And if you enter the code kickass when you check out, you'll get a free 2-week trial so you can listen to all the courses that you want. So please go do that and try that out. Okay, himalaya.com/kickass. All right, so this is our chat with Dan at the Tudor Learning Circle, tudorlearningcircle.com, to find out more about live chats and stuff like that. I also want to say that while this was being recorded, my daughter was home and I was by myself with her. And she had a really bad cough. So I'm trying to edit out all of the coughs. I might not get them all. I'm doing my best. I'm really doing my best, you guys. Isn't that what we're all doing right now? We're just all doing our best. So also, it was, you know, a Zoom call, so the sound isn't always perfect. But I think you'll get a lot out of the conversation. We talk a lot about Shakespeare. Was Christopher Marlowe a spy? We talk about, was the authorship controversy? All kinds of good stuff. So enjoy. And definitely go to shakespeareproves.com to check out more about your friendly neighborhood Shakespeare. Book him for your next party. All right, enjoy.
More than any man, low northern wind, sinful may be sweating, low northern wind, blow, blow, blow.
All right, well, we're here to talk to Shakespeare, so
we can make it all about Spain. I'm cool with that.
No. That's false advertising. So I advertise Shakespeare. So
we're talking to Shakespeare.
We're talking Shakespeare. Gosh darn it. Okay. So, all right. So I think probably like people who are on this call know who you are, and the general people who are TudorCon people know who you are. But this is going to go out to my podcast, and not everybody knows who you are. So tell me who you are.
Hi, everyone. I am Dan Kostelec. I play your friendly neighborhood Shakespeare at Renaissance festivals and schools and libraries and your random mass birthday party all over the East Coast of the United States, so, and a little further inland as well. So I do New York and New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Delaware, Virginia, Maryland, Louisiana, Florida. Kind of skip the Carolinas a bit, but
yeah,
it is great. I've been doing it for 15 years now. One-man audience interactive improvisational Shakespeare show that I call Shakespeare Approves, because I'm Will Shakespeare, and I approve of this message. Which cool. always gets a bigger laugh in non-election years. Election right. years, people are like, please don't say that.
So sick of hearing it. So sick of hearing it. That's funny. All right. So we have a couple things we're going to talk about today, including authorship questions.
Oh, yeah.
Mysteries and the sonnets. That kind of goes along with authorship questions. So we're going to talk a little bit about the sonnets and who wrote the sonnets and all of that. Whether Marlowe was a spy, because I think that's fun. And also, I didn't email you this, but it kind of came to my head about 20 minutes ago that given the time of year it is, we should talk a little bit about Macbeth and witches and James the First and witchcraft. I don't know if you can talk about any of that.
This is stuff I like to dive deep on. Awesome. And Wikipedia and YouTube are my friends for like rabbit holes. Like one thing that coronavirus has been amazing to me. It's been a wonderful boon. In as much that, because I am self-employed, I have lots of random time on my hands now, and I can fall down Wikipedia rabbit holes that will take me from breakfast time until way after dinner, and I'm just going down it, and sometimes my wife will jump in the rabbit hole with me, and she's like, what you doing, and we'll watch videos and read articles together, and sometimes she's just like, okay, you have fun, and I'm gonna, you know, live my life. I'm like, cool. Oh no, I really need to learn more about why they changed monetary units. It's a fascinating. It's just like, why? I don't know. For a joke.
The change of the calendar.
Change of calendar. Like, let's make jokes about being secret Catholics inside of England. So it's just like, I'm not gonna listen to your calendar. I'm gonna try to avoid eating meat at this point on Meatless Fridays, but
yeah.
Okay.
And that was before they had any kind of like vegan burgers and stuff, so you couldn't like sneak a meatless burger, right? Now you could just—
Oh my gosh. Oh, can I say, Boca Burgers, Impossible Burgers, etc. Yeah. Those are such a boon to my personal lifestyle.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, oh man, I can go out to eat. I can go to Red Robin with people. And it's amazing.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the authorship question. So why is there a mystery around Shakespeare's plays?
Why
are there so many books about people who are saying that there's a mystery around Shakespeare's plays? I think that because, like, how can one person— and I have written— not have this knowledge, like, okay, and I guess when I say authorship, I also mean like these lost years of his between when he was in Stratton and when he shows up in London, and like, what was he doing and how did he get knowledge from like shipping and like Greeks at tragedy and like Italy, and like how does that lead to the questions about who he really was?
Sure, absolutely. and on that I also question the authorship of every single Stephen King book.
Okay.
Because of the same reason, how can one person be so prolific? The reason that there is a question or a controversy or anything is because people are elitist. And, this guy who is a glover's son from Warwickshire, he can't possibly have written all of this stuff. He can't possibly have knowledge. Whereas a lot of the expert knowledge that you see demonstrated in the plays is surface level only. It's I heard a conversation between two barristers talking about a law case. And so, oh, I have a little bit of knowledge of the law. Oh, I heard a conversation between a few sailors. And so we're going to talk about the seashore of Italy, or to yell yar in Tempest. His geography is wrong. His knowledge of sailing and the law and courts, surface level. Or maybe a little bit deeper at times, because he'll know people who know people who know people. It's like, oh, well, you know, one time I had a friend who had a cousin whose aunt worked for the Queen's Maid. It's just like, oh wow. Obviously, this is deep inside knowledge.
Right.
But everybody doesn't want to say that it could just be a Glover's son from Stratford in the middle of Warwickshire who could do this. Someone who grew up in the now burgeoning middle class of England, but was not a gentleman, was not university educated, was not in the circles of court. It's, so it has to be, obviously, Edward de Vere or Francis Bacon or Christopher Marlowe using a pseudonym or Queen Elizabeth Regina Gloriana herself, because she's got nothing else to do. Like,
is
while
that a
running
theory?
A country.
I haven't heard that one.
Oh yeah, that's one.
Wow.
And so, especially since the movie Anonymous came out several years ago, I like signing tweets and just random things. Some every once in a while, hashtag suck it Derek Jacobi, because yes, he is a brilliant Shakespearean actor and director, but he is a proponent of the Oxfordian theory that it was Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, who wrote all of this. And it's not. Look at de Vere's published works. They're not good. And also, he died way before about half of the plays were done. And so it's like, well, his son-in-law was involved. And so, like, you start creating a wider conspiracy around that there's all these different nobles and gentry working on the plays of Shakespeare. But that just doesn't really fit in with Occam's razor, because the entire conspiracy would have fallen apart. It's just like, simplest thing being what it is, it was this relatively uneducated kid from the Midlands, who listened. And that's what actors and writers do. They listen to people and start extrapolating from there.
Gotcha.
And also, the equivalent of an eighth grade education, which is what Shakespeare had in that period, was really freaking high. It was, I mean, maybe not a university level education that we would have now, but at the very least taking you up to was probably the equivalent of a full-on high school education for the period. And you spent a lot of time reading the classics, reading, doing your numbers, learning basic world history and geography. So he'd have at least a primer level of,
and it would
knowing
be more.
What.
I mean, I suspect it would be even more, in some ways, deeper than what an eighth grade education would be now, because he's reading in Latin and he's learning foreign languages in ways that we don't, and translating and things.
And you're learning the stuff by rote as well. It's when he's learning Ovid, he's learning to quote Ovid. It's not just, oh, I can kind of read it in a little bit of Latin, like little Latin, less Greek, maybe for speaking purposes, but also being able to do the translations for it. It's one of those things that most school children would have known. And saying most school children isn't saying like, oh yeah, every kid in America nowadays.
Right.
Most school children largely meant boys, and the grouping of people was not wide.
Right.
Was, Shakespeare's father at one point was a town magistrate, having a position in town for Stratford, roughly equivalent to that of a mayor nowadays. So the family was of some means, and he and his siblings were able to go to school. His sister Joanna did not, as far as we can tell, but probably had some private tutelage at home, if only from her brothers, saying, well, here's how you read this and all that. Now, we know his wife, Anne Hathaway, no real education to speak of, but his daughters did have it. So this was a family of means. This was a family who did go to school.
Right. And I wanted to ask you about his early life, too, because I've heard this tantalizing idea that he was at the Robert Dudley's 1575 Kenilworth last ditch effort to have Queen Elizabeth marry him. So what can you tell me? Was that, could that be? And do you know anything about that?
So I do actually, that's so funny that you mentioned that one. I do know a little bit about that from a wonderful book called Will in the World. Oh, yeah. So you know Stephen, that book too.
Stephen Greenblatt. Yeah.
Yes. It's a great, it's a great biography.
Yeah.
Going on just the scant bits that we have, circumstantial evidence. But you know what? If the Oxfordians are allowed to use circumstantial evidence, so are the Stratfordians. So let's do this. Shakespeare would have been, 11 at the time of going to Dudley's blowout. And getting to sing Queen Bess in all of her Gloriana glory. She'd been on the throne, 20 years at that point? Just the height of power. You're going into the Gloriana period, the years just before the Spanish Armada coming to face off against the minuscule English Navy. And Shakespeare got to see spectacle for the first time. Now, you'd probably seen theater, just roving bands of players coming into town, as was the want, and we still do, except this the year of the Murder Hornets. But because that's the big thing, keeping us all home, right? Murder Hornets.
Right, the Murder Hornets, totally.
Yeah. but he saw spectacle, large, grandiose, for the first time. And this was spectacle that you would also not see in the theaters. Now, one of the fun things is, just a weird coincidence, Dudley's spectacle for Queen Bess when she was on Progress coincided with the start of the first theaters in London. Purely coincidental of the same time period, but they learned from each other of, oh, we can do that. Oh, that's neat.
And Leicester had a troupe of players, right?
Yes. So. Most nobles did. Most nobles were the sponsor, the patron of a group of players. So he had Leicester's men. But there were also troops that would come and go, being the Queen's men, the Lord Chamberlain's players, and so on. So Shakespeare's company was the Lord Chamberlain's, periodically the Lord Chamberlain's men, the Lord Chamberlain's players. They became the Queen's men, lost that after the death of Bess, and then regained it very quickly, becoming the King's men. So his company at the Globe, where he was a shareholder. Yeah, so not uncommon. So that being a very huge moment in a period, I think, that would have been talked about for years afterward, of you have this fantastic mermaid statue that's
and didn't they have like musicians hidden underground and or like under the water, and then they were like in the shell, and then the shell opens up and there's like musicians there, and it was
you had mechanical production happening of a siren coming out of the water, out of this man-made lake that he had made for the purpose of the queen coming to his house. With fountains coming out of it, as you said, the clamshell opening, musicians hidden in spaces under water. So elaborate, so dangerous for the time as well. I mean, that's dangerous to do now. And it's just... It was for the queen, but everyone had to be there because this had to get talked about, and not just by the noble classes.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second just to get back on why he might have been there. So he might have been there because Kenilworth was what, like 9 miles or something from.
Yeah, it wasn't even like a day's walk. It was a couple hours walk. And if you took a cart or a horse, you could be there probably in an hour.
And his father, having been a magistrate, might have had some role in planning.
If not in the actual planning, being a member of the local hoity-toities, right. Let's say, okay. Like, oh well, here's the magistrate of Stratford, Your Majesty, and just going through the receiving line. Of course, yes, right. hello, yes, elbow, wrist. Would Will have met her? No,
right.
But
right.
Would his father? Quite probably, and even though they were in theory. Died in the wool Catholics because of her sister Mary. At the same point, every indication is led to believe that his father was incredibly loyal to the concept of just the monarchy, and like, we're not going to be Catholics that raise up against her. And his father had a just fun side tangent on that. His father would not go to church. And we have that in records because his father would get fined for not going to church because, you know, no separation of church and state.
Right.
But, some people say, well, that shows that they were Catholic. Not necessarily. It also shows that his father had debt.
Right.
And just like, okay. Oh no, if I go, they can fine me. Right. It's like, nope, they can catch me. So just not go because the rest of the family would go. Like, oh, we're not going to find Mrs. Shakespeare, just Mr. Shakespeare.
Okay, because I have heard that they might have been Catholics because of that, but you don't think that's... Okay.
I mean, it's one of those coin flips. It could go either way, because lots of people would avoid going to church because they couldn't afford to pay the tithes that were at set amounts. It wasn't just like dropping a few coins. It was at set percentages that you had to do it.
So was the fine higher than to not, the fine was less than the tithe was?
No, the fine was higher, but it just like reached this point of like, oh, I didn't go for so long. And now I have, it's basically just turn, like you see a police car ahead and you have outstanding parking tickets. And it's so petty at this point of, well, if the police don't catch me, I don't lose my driver's license. So I don't go to church. They don't put me in jail or charge me a lot of money.
Right.
So the bills are stacking up.
I see.
I'm just going to avoid you. And so like his father left public life, was no longer a town magistrate. There's some documentary evidence of Shakespeare paying off lots of debts for his father as he, in the late 1590s, as he started getting more successful, more money. He pursued the coat of arms for the family to be moved into gentry. His father didn't actually get to see that. His father died before that happened. But his children got to bear the rank of gentle. So
nice.
For a brief period.
Good for them. I'm sure that was nice for them. Okay. And so does the question... I have a question about these lost years. Like, so what can you tell me about... So there's this idea, there's like a period where he just goes missing, right?
Yeah.
So
excuse me, I beg your pardon.
Oh no.
So you're talking from between the births, after the birth of the twins until you have the first published works and all that.
Right.
The best evidence, as someone who believes in the Shakespeare is the author of his own stuff, is that he was a working actor on the road. He took up with a playing company when they came through town, and not necessarily wanting to be a country rustic, having the wanderlust saying, this is the job for me and I can completely and totally relate on my own.
Yeah, sure.
he went out on a theater with a theater company because it was the best way for him to make money for him and his now growing family. He has three kids, all small. He's not even 21 years old.
And he might not be completely in love with his wife, given that she was older and pregnant when they got married, right?
Yeah.
So it might be a fun escape.
Yeah. A fun joke I always say is the kids aren't even mine, which is the thing like people always say.
Right.
Like, oh, those aren't my kids.
Yeah.
But I like to take as a joke the whole concept that Christopher Marlowe is, you know, the author of Shakespeare, one of the potential. I say, those are my plays. Those plays are my children. Now, my children are his, actually. No, my actual physical kids, those are his. No, those are Marlowe's kids. Yeah. Playing with fun silliness of just turn it on its head. But lots of evidence that it was lust that drove him and Anne together. And then when reality set in, it was, oh boy.
Yeah.
I'm 18, 19 years old. Don't really know what I'm doing yet. Now, granted, you are, in the eyes of the law, fully a grown up at that point. But no one is going to take a 19-year-old seriously doing much of anything.
Right.
And he hit the bricks.
And so when you talk about traveling players coming through, that this is the period, like you said, when theaters were just getting started. Tell me about this this kind of movement. My mind is losing itself right now. This movement from like traveling players and the medieval versions of like these Christmas plays and things like that to the theater. And we're in this period of transition with that right now, right? Yeah.
So yes, exactly. So the very first theater in England was the theater.
The theater, right? Yes.
Truth so in original. Advertising. Owned by Burbage. Owned by, I think they had the same first name. Richard Burbage. It might have been Edward. I'm losing that. But Burbage's father, Burbage, the famous actor who worked with Shakespeare, it was his father. He was the guy. He was the imprimatur producer of theatricals in London. Now, getting up to that point, you had traveling players. You had touring companies. So, hey, we're doing Spamalot. Great, send it on the road. We're doing whatever. So at this point, we're gonna do Everyman. We're gonna send it on the road, and we're gonna do a mummer's some mummer's show, or we're gonna do this Christmas pageant. And you had the 1500s up. So basically, the entire Tudor period was the point of. You see the morality plays start to get good. You go from Everyman and you have narrators just talking people through dumb show into a point of actors now declaiming their own lines into now wholly original works getting done. And this is where you see the people immediately presaging Shakespeare coming in. And it's not great, but for the period, it is something else. It is something that people had never seen before. Oh, this is an original story. This is amazing. You start seeing history plays happen. You start seeing more elaborate versions of the Passion of the Christ, or the Christmas story, as we had mentioned, and being performed in town squares. Usually, like you would have a wagon that would, like. Have parts collapse off of it and you start building up your stage. Sometimes you get to go into a town hall or a great lord's house or just like a local landed gentry's house. They would have a great hall, invite sometimes just their friends, the entire town, the whole countryside in. You'd play for a night, you'd play for a weekend, you'd play for a week. Mm-hmm. Kind of just like touring companies now. Each of the great lords was the sponsor starting in around the 1530s of a roving band of players because... it looked good. You are a proponent of the arts. This goes back all the way into the reign of King Richard II. Richard II was a huge sponsor of the arts, specifically with some up-and-comer named Geoffrey Chaucer.
Right, of course. Okay.
Going back to royal patronage of the arts in England at that point, go forward, everybody's doing it because everybody wants to do what the king or the queen does.
And as an actor, as a troupe of actors, you would want to have this sponsorship to make yourself more legit, right?
Yes.
Like so you could go into town and...
Yes, because there are roving bands of actors that don't have sponsorship. They also have less money. They pay less well. They don't have as good of reputations. And they're also the ones who will do the more scandalous plays. We have women in our company. And it's just
There were actually women at
There were women playing women, and some of them were so heavily done up in order to potentially look like a man playing a woman. So right. they're a woman
playing
dressed
a man.
As a man.
Yeah.
Playing a woman, which then wow. once you get into the actual Shakespearean period, you have men playing women, but then men playing women playing men.
Right.
Just
right.
It's like, let's just keep going with this. And right. of course, okay. we don't get to the first legal and legitimate actresses on stage until the 1660s in the Restoration period. But
yeah.
That's outside of our purview right now.
Sure.
So yeah, the touring companies were massively important because it brought people culture, brought people literature to an extent. It gave people entertainment. There's no local theater company that you get to go see on a regular mm-hmm. basis. Theater as a concept of go to the theater is a future concept, or rather a long in the past concept of the Greeks and the Romans. But it came to England because of Commedia dell'arte. The Italian players all booked it out of Italy and a lot of Europe in the late Middle Ages because of plague. And they get to England, they don't speak the language, but they can play things large, broad, and in silly pantomime. And that's where, and they started wearing, and they had always done masks, but they start using more of them and making them even more comical than ever before in order to cross the language barriers. And that became a lot of the basis for many of the roving theatrical companies that would go throughout the countryside and then also play in the great houses of the nobility. And then one of them, they got together enough money to build their own playhouse, the theater. Mm-hmm. The next one was the Curtain, followed by the Rose. And by the late 1570s, you have a thriving theater ecosystem in London, where all of the companies would also do road shows, sometimes out of sheer necessity because, it's plague season in London. Let's get out of town. But also to make more money. Mm-hmm. You would try stuff out in the sticks. If it's working out there, bring them back to London, and also vice versa.
Mm. And so I'm so interested about this whole, the rise of the theaters and how they had to be outside the city limits, right? Because this was Puritans rising and eventually leading to the English Civil War and shutting it all down. And
oh, yeah, that. Yeah, Puritans, no fun.
Right. Exactly. And and so
speaking of Puritans now, happy Halloween. Let's burn some witches.
Why not? And then you're taking me to Macbeth, but I don't want to go there yet because that's a little bit later. So I do want to talk about just a little bit. So I do want to talk about the theater, because the specific theater, not the theater in general, but the theater, because was that the one that they had to tear down and they rolled across the river? Can you tell me that story?
Yeah. All right. So this actually, it happened multiple times. So Shakespeare, the more famous one is Shakespeare's Globe. Mm-hmm. They owned the actual, so I'm telling you that one first in order to tell you the older one. Okay. Shakespeare's Globe in the 1590s was on the north side of the Thames, outside of the city limits, and the city limits were basically the old Roman wall portion of the city. So you're London, but you're not London. Now, right. Like Westminster, of course, is London. Southwark is
yes,
London.
Of course.
So they owned the building, but not the land. And in order to get shut down, the masters of the revels and puritanical members of parliament were like, you know what, we're gonna put pressure on this landowner. The theater company gets word of it, takes it down. The river is at this moment frozen solid
because it's Christmas time.
They skated across the river, tear the whole thing down, put it on a piece of land that they bought in Southwark, and start putting it back up. Now, they didn't put it all back up in one night, but they took enough of it down.
Yeah. And the landlord was away. The landlord was at his country house, right? And didn't know that
so
this was going.
No one was able to do anything. Yeah. And they had already bought land. They were going to open another theater on the south side of the river, but just like, you know what? We're just moving it. We're not so dealing awesome. With this. You're not going to shut us down. And since we were are now since Southwark was considered not the city of London at all, it's the sketchy side of the river. We're going to be over there, and that's where basically the original version of the West End all started. Because you then have the Rose, the Curtain, the Globe, the Theater, so many others in that section of town. That's where you had the bear baiting pit and the cockfighting. And
that's also where the houses of ill repute were and things.
Oh, like most of, but with very good reputations, to quote Shakespeare in Love. Yeah, that's where all of that was. And partly why acting continued to have such a terrible reputation, because right, you were okay. next to the houses of ill repute. You were next to the public houses, the taverns, everything, where everybody would go. But the genteel members of society just wouldn't talk about it. And so they're not there. The theater went through a very similar situation. They didn't go so far as to let's move it across the river, but they did tear it down and rebuild it a few blocks away at another outside of the city limits.
And yeah, so they would also be like up near Islington and stuff too, right? It wasn't just like, it was just kind of outside as long as you
Yeah,
were.
It was, you just needed to, because the legal bans of the city
right.
were so determined. So, oh, all right, I just need to go six blocks that way.
Okay.
Done. So like Blackfriars, which was the first indoor theater in England, owned by Shakespeare's company, and was able, had the virtue of being able to now be indoors, I mean, and thus year round, was outside of the city gates. They were by the Blackfriars Gate, but outside of the city. They were on the, I think, on the Westminster side. And so, and then, but by that point, it was, the theaters were thriving and no one was really pushing against them. Not for another 20 some years would it become a problem.
Okay, and so we've got Shakespeare. He's probably a traveling player, and then he shows up in London, probably having worked his way up through the player ranks, and
yeah.
he's like,
and
okay,
like offering a rewrite to a line here. Oh, let's change this line. Oh, hey, I've been working on something. Can you let me slip it in? So you're writing stuff, maybe going anywhere from just writing some scenes to I'm gonna write a whole short play. So. You have early ones. You have the second part of King Henry VI. Fun history. It was the only one he wrote at the time. Yeah, wrote. It was the only part he had written at the time. So it was just King Henry VI. But you also have Titus Andronicus, which is not good. But it is fun. And it was exactly what Elizabethan audiences wanted to see. It was gory, it had action, it had revenge, it had onstage fights, it had it all. And it had some of the first well-written women on the English stage. And they were well-written women, even though women weren't allowed on stage, because, well, this younger male actor who can play a woman, or this actor with a higher voice or whatever, this really terrific actor, let's see what Ned Allen can do, for instance. Yeah. You want to give them some juicy material, otherwise they're gonna maybe leave the company.
Sure.
And you need it to be a draw, so that's why Shakespeare's women tend to be so well drawn out.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have men playing it, and so it was a sexist reason,
right.
But you end up with characters who are still beautifully well written today.
Awesome. Okay, so I think we got everything here, and it's been an hour, and you've been so generous with your time, and I am so grateful to you. Thank you for being at TudorCon. I appreciate you taking this time now, and then I'm going to put this out on my podcast. There, we've got an applause coming up. So, thank you so much. And
I live to hang out with my people, the nerds.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.